This is Booktown. You're new here, aren't you? Maybe I should show you around. You can get anything you want here. Anything you want. Anything you desire. Anything you can imagine. It's all here. It's all free. It's all for you. Come on. I'll show you around. If you've got the guts. This is Booktown. You can get anything you want here. Anything you need.
And it is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, and I'll be with you till 2 p.m. Well, not quite. I'm someplace completely different, but my voice will be with you till 2 p.m. I'm recording this program last Wednesday on my kitchen counter, and it should be all in place to be broadcast on Monday, the 11th of May. Two other voices will be with me in this hour. In the first 25 minutes or so, I'll be talking with journalist and author Tony Horwitz about his book, A Journey Long and Strange, which has just been published in paperback. Later in the program, we're going to listen to a section of a talk which Douglas Adams gave at the University of California in Santa Barbara just a few months before his sudden death in 2001. Tony Horwitz is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist whose first book, Baghdad Without Maps, was, I imagine, a pretty serious journalistic effort. But he's best known for his often comical excursions after facts of history. Probably his best known of these was the first one, Confederates in the Attic, in which he started traveling around the old Confederacy, finding Confederate reenactors, lost cause purists, amateur historians, and anyone who in some way was still enthralled by the myth of the Civil War. He then wrote a book called Blue Latitudes, which is subtitled something like Boldly Going Where Captain Cook Has Previously Sailed or Already Sailed, something like that, which is about following the path Captain Cook took through the South Seas in the 1770s. This most recent book, A Voyage Long and Strange, is his encounters with early American history. Although he was a history major in college, he realizes that he knew nothing about the period between Columbus's landing in somewhere in the Bahamas in 1492 and the Pilgrim's landing in Massachusetts in 1620. He made a point of researching this period, spending about 3 years, a lot of which was in libraries and online, and then following most of the recorded explorers of that period. He actually starts out with the Vikings coming to North America around 1000 AD, because they are the first people to reach America who actually have a historical record, then goes on to Columbus, and then follows mostly the Spanish who explored the American South and Southwest, much of which he says he knew nothing about until he began this book. He finally goes into the first settlers of Virginia, the French Huguenot settlers of the area just above Florida, the Spanish who settled St. Augustine in Florida, and finally the Jamestown settlement in 1607 and the Pilgrims in 1620. The title I had to ask him, although I knew the answer, did not come from the Grateful Dead. A Voyage Long and Strange was actually the description one of Columbus's contemporaries gave of his first expedition to the New World. the beginning of this interview mysteriously vanished when we start. Tony Horwitz is talking about why and how he started following the Viking explorers.
The Vikings are the first Europeans that we know of to reach this continent, North America, and they did so 1,000 years ago. And the reason we know they got there is that archaeologists have found a site at the northern tip of Newfoundland where there's remains of that brief Norse settlement. And I go there as a part of my research. I have to say it's a place that only a Norseman could love. Even in summer when I visited, there were icebergs in the bay and my breath clouded in the 40-degree air.
And mosquitoes and moose.
Yeah. On the coast, you have a wicked wind. But the one virtue of that is when you don't have it, when you're inland, the bugs just swarm all over you. And the moose all over the road are another hazard of driving through Newfoundland.
And one of the things that happened with the Vikings was that they encountered people already there. This was part of the story that would repeat again and again and again.
Exactly. They encountered natives whom they called Skraelings. This was a derogatory term that translates roughly as ugly screeching wretches. The Skraelings outnumbered the Vikings and also were more skillful at combat in the New World, in boats shooting arrows and catapults. So that in the end, the Vikings concluded that they couldn't settle there. So in the first encounter between newcomers and natives, the home team won.
You can tell us this fairly authoritatively because they left pretty complete records of their explorations, even personal stories. Almost everything you did, you started out by reading the records first.
Yeah, there are dozens and dozens of accounts about the early exploration and settlement of America by Europeans, and these accounts are generally by the people who were there themselves, and that's what I relied on for the most part. They're not always reliable in every detail, or it's impossible to determine if they are, but they nonetheless give us a very rich and thrilling and sometimes even comic image of what it was like to stumble on this new world that Europeans really were unaware of.
And I think you sometimes find the written records much more reliable than the testimony of the people on the sites you visit.
Now, sadly, while I love going to the places where history happened and talking to people there about that history and how they remember and honor it, there does tend to be a local bias. People here in New England understandably exalt the importance of Plymouth Rock. In Virginia, they'll talk about Jamestown. In the Southwest, the Spanish are all important. And inevitably, when you have that kind of stake in the history, you may shade it a bit to exaggerate the importance of what happened in your community or to gloss over some of the horrors that occurred there.
But some of the shading is pretty extreme, like in St. Augustine.
Yeah, well, St. Augustine is an instance where myth and commerce have come together in a rather dramatic fashion. So that you have many sites there that are billed as historic that are really fictional. They're fun as long as you're aware of that. But I think, unfortunately, they don't do as good a job as they might in St. Augustine of letting you know what's real history and what's not.
And in particular, this whole question of Ponce de Leon and the Fountain of Youth seems to have no real historical foundation, and if it did, it had nothing to do with St. Augustine.
Yeah, correct. If we remember Ponce de Leon at all today, it's as this sort of old conquistador looking for eternal youth. In fact, he was only 39 at the time of his voyage, and there's no evidence he was looking for a fountain of youth. He was looking for gold and slaves. But St. Augustine has sort of taken that story and run with it. At one time, I think there were three competing fountains of youth you could visit in St. Augustine. Now there's just one, this rather fanciful park where you can sip sort of mineral water and imagine that the years are peeling away.
In all of your travels, when you followed the Spanish, they were almost always looking for gold. Some of the other settlers or explorers had other goals or other desires.
It's true. The Spanish were often looking to get rich quick from gold. They were also looking for land and the opportunity to exploit Indian labor. But I think we have to be careful not to draw too sharp a line between the Spanish and the later arriving English. Contrary, I think, to what many of us imagine, the first English here weren't humble farmers tilling the soil. They were slave traders, they were castaways, and at Jamestown, they came really looking for gold, same as the Spanish. It was only kind of by default that they began growing things and trying to earn a hard living off the land.
I'd like to sort of follow your route for a little bit. You started with the Vikings, then you went to Columbus, and then you wound up in the Dominican Republic, the one place outside of the United States. Why did you go there?
I went to the Dominican Republic because, in contradiction to what I imagined before I began this book, Columbus actually never set foot on what's now the United States. He never reached North America. He established the first really significant European colony in the Americas on the island of Hispaniola. So I went there to what's now the Dominican Republic, really to try and understand what that colonization was like and the long-term legacy of it. So I had a kind of wild ride around the Dominican Republic on the trail of Columbus.
And then you went into the Gulf Coast with Cabeza de Vaca, and then into the Southwest with Coronado. Tell us a little bit about, these are people that, of all the people you wrote about, I probably knew the most about, but that was just happenstance. Many people don't know about them at all.
Mm-hmm. I think the two best-known conquistadors who came to North America were Hernando de Soto and Francisco Coronado. And I follow their epic treks, really. Each of their expeditions covered thousands of miles, really reaching almost half of today's United States, all the way to central Kansas. But I also try and work in some of the lesser-known Spanish figures like Cabeza de Vaca, who's in some ways a much more sympathetic figure, a castaway who wanders the continent for 8 years, all the way from Florida to the Gulf of California, and undergoes really a conversion experience. He sets out to conquer Indians and ends up being their great defender.
You've read so many books as background. Did you ever see the movie Cabeza de Vaca?
Yeah, I did. I saw a very peculiar Mexican movie based on this story. It didn't, as far as I could tell, have much to do with the account that Cabeza de Vaca left, but it was sort of an interesting, surreal movie, if that's the one you mean.
Yeah, it has a very shamanistic feel to it.
Yep, that's the way I'd describe it.
So both Coronado and De Soto were, I would, from our point of view, moral monsters, but you came to admire them in many ways for their endurance.
I don't think we have to approve of these figures to nonetheless be awed by what they did and recognize the significance of it. They came here at a time when people or Europeans really didn't have a clue what was here, and marched and rode on and on and on through very difficult terrain. Through all kinds of hardships, ultimately in vain, and neither of them found what they were looking for. They didn't find riches, and De Soto died in the process. So I was, if not admiring, just in awe of what they did. Just the sheer endurance of those expeditions, I think, is just incredible by our modern lights.
Returning to the native people that the explorers encountered, Coronado and some of his successors didn't have that much of an impact on the what we would call Indian life, but De Soto's passage through the southeast, you say, was actually worse than Sherman's march to the sea.
Yeah, absolutely. I wouldn't diminish the impact of Coronado. He really opened the way to colonization of the Southwest by the Spanish. But it's true, his initial foray, at least in terms of disease, wasn't as hugely destructive as other expeditions. He did kill a lot of people in battle. But De Soto is really, he really takes the cake for sort of barbarity in this era. He leads what's essentially a death march across the entire South, enslaving Indians, killing them in battle, and also leaving behind disease that just wipes out entire societies. The South and the great civilizations that had flourished there really are transformed by his expedition. And Spanish who come to the same area just 20 years later don't recognize the place that De Soto and his men had described because it's simply vanished.
The place was there, but the people were gone.
Exactly. These what archaeologists call mound societies, these great settlements centered on ceremonial mounds. Some of them had thousands of people. I mean, these were large settlements. And this area, the South and the Mississippi Valley, were very heavily populated and cultivated. And again, within a few decades, those societies or the people had all but vanished, and the signs of this quite sophisticated civilization had gone with them.
And the same thing happened to a slightly lesser degree farther north, where the English settled.
Yeah, I think one of the many notions that we need to overturn is that somehow the pilgrims, for instance, arrived in what we think of as a virgin wilderness. This wasn't at all the case. In fact, Samuel de Champlain, who visited Plymouth 15 years before the pilgrims, described and drew a thriving settlement of several thousand people. But in between his visit and the arrival of the pilgrims, Europeans brought a terrible epidemic to the coast of New England that killed most of its inhabitants. So that when the pilgrims arrived at Plymouth, they found essentially a ghost village. There was water there and fields, readied for corn. It was a convenient place for them to settle, but its original inhabitants had vanished.
When De Soto landed in the southeast, he was fortunate to find a Spanish, essentially a left-behind person who had learned the native languages. When the English landed, they found that many of the natives already knew English.
Yeah, in the Pilgrims' accounts, they describe their first meeting with an Indian at Plymouth. They'd sort of had fleeting contact up to that point, but the first to approach them calls out to them in English, and that's because he's Samoset. He's a refugee from Maine who had clearly had contact with the English fishermen probably before. So again, the pilgrims were far from the first to get there. And also the first thing he does is ask them for beer. So I found that in some ways a rather comic episode.
And the person we call Squanto had even been to England.
Yeah, Squanto was a native of Massachusetts who had actually been kidnapped by earlier English visitors and taken first to Spain, and then he had reached England and found his way from there to Canada and then back to his home in the village that became Plymouth. And in the time he'd been away, this terrible epidemic had struck. So he was really perhaps the only survivor of this place. So he was very helpful to the English because obviously he knew the territory and he spoke some English and was able to act as an intermediary.
Toward the end of the book, you are, as you begin your reflections on what you've encountered in your 3 years or travel to all these places, you mentioned that Americans don't so much study history as shop for it. Do you think you were shopping?
I guess you could say I was shopping in a sense, but I was saying that in reference to places like St. Augustine, again, where the history has become very commercialized. And also we do sort of tick off historic sites like a shopping list, sort of. We rush through them, you know. You know, I guess I prefer to linger a bit and dig a bit deeper and try and peel away the modernity and try and see these places as they once were.
And you did your homework.
Well, I tried to do my homework. I had the leisure of, several years of reading and research. So I came to these sites, yes, perhaps better prepared than most tourists.
And the people who do just go as shoppers, do you think they get a true picture? We talked about this a little bit at the beginning, but it's a good point to come back to.
Right. I'm glad for every visitor at these historic, sites. Obviously, I love history, and, I'd rather people were visiting these sites than, going to Disney World. At the good ones, at the national park sites, I think visitors do learn a tremendous amount if they try. The resources are there. But occasionally, yes, there are other sites where I think people come really just to confirm the notions, perhaps, that they had before arriving. Or they're just sort of whizzing by and feel they need to make an obligatory visit, say, for the sake of their children and, pause to look at Plymouth Rock.
One of the most interesting things was not just the official sites you went to, but many of the inhabitants, especially people who lived a little ways away, who had quite often very ambivalent feelings toward their heritage. The people who were, in some cases, they were fierce defenders of, say, Protestantism as opposed to Catholicism. You talk about the French Huguenots who landed on the South Carolina, Florida, I guess it was the Georgia-Florida border before St. Augustine. Son, I'm in somebody else's room, and we're going to hear his phone, and then we're going to hear his answering machine. But I'm just going to walk to the other side of the room, and I will, I'll walk out of the room, and I'll let you, we're almost done, so.
Okay, good.
and then you, there was the fairly contentious Protestant Catholic split that you found in certain places, and in other places you found people who really were unsure of their heritage, like black Indian combinations, or a Jew who really would have preferred to have been a Native American, and so on.
Right. I think people are, in a sense, searching to understand their own identity in this history. And I think in some ways that was most interesting in North Carolina and Virginia, site of the first English settlement, because there you really have the story of three peoples coming together, Native Americans, Europeans, and then African Americans who were brought to the area as slaves. And, their descendants of all those groups are still living there today, cheek by jowl. And so they look at the same history in very different ways and try and draw lessons or degree of pride from them. So I found it very interesting to sort of visit, representatives of each of those communities and see how they remember this history.
And your family, I think you said, has only been in the U.S. for three generations. How did it make you feel?
I felt it gave me an advantage, really, in a situation like that in Jamestown, where people were sort of debating about history that occurred 400 years ago on this continent. In one sense, I'm jealous because, my own roots basically just go back to lower Manhattan at the turn of the last century. But on the other hand, I think it allowed me to look at this without having an axe to grind or a particular bias. I don't really have a pony in this race to the start line of American history of who was here first or who was most important or who did what. I'm interested in all of it. And so, you know, in that sense, I perhaps I was able to step back and take the broad view of this history.
This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. We just heard a recording of an interview I conducted last week with journalist and author Tony Horwitz about his book, A Voyage Long and Strange, which has just come out in paperback from Picador Books. Douglas Adams was born on this day in 1952. He's best known, of course, for The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the 5 books in all in the Hitchhiker's trilogy, and the Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency series, which only got to 2 books. He procrastinated the 3rd one and never finished it. In the meantime, he got to working with a naturalist friend, Mark Carwardine, and the two of them put together a book called Last Chance to See, which is about their travels around the world in search of endangered and vanishing species. Douglas Adams claims that this is his favorite work. It was the last one he completed, so that makes sense. And it's the one that, in a way, he put the most energy into because he had to travel many places to do it. And it involved not just making jokes, but seriously grappling with a lot of environmental problems. Shortly before his death in 2001, which came very unexpectedly from a rare kind of heart attack that I don't think he even knew he was liable to, he spoke for 87 minutes at the University of California in Santa Barbara, which he had come to think of as his hometown. We're going to hear the first roughly 25 minutes of that talk. You can get the whole thing by going to UCTV.tv and using whatever search apparatus they have there. It's also available on YouTube, and I will have a direct link on the Booktown blog, which is at booktown.blogspot.com. So here's Douglas Adams talking about the first of the adventures that made up his book, Last Chance to See.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. It's a very interesting and unusual and weird experience for me to be talking in my hometown, which is... Now, amongst the books that Constance mentioned when she was introducing me, Hitchhiker's Guide, Dirk Gently, and so on, was not my favorite book. And my favorite book is what I'm here to talk about tonight. It's funny how often, virtually every author I know, their own favorite book is the one that sold the least. It's the runt of the litter. It's the one you always just sort of love the most. And I want to tell you about how this came about. Sometime in about the mid-1980s, the phone rang. And the voice said, "We want you to go to Madagascar. We want you to look for a very rare form of lemur called the aye-aye. The plane leaves in 2 weeks. We'd like you to be on it." Now, I, assuming they got the wrong number, said yes before they could discover their mistake. But in fact, it turned out that they decided, here's somebody who doesn't know anything about lemurs, anything about the aye-aye, anything about Madagascar. Let's send him. And so I started to try and find out something about it. And it turns out it's very interesting. Lemurs used to be the dominant primate in all the world. And they were very, very gentle, pleasant creatures. They were a little bit like sort of cat size. And they used to hang around in the trees having a nice time. And then Gondwanaland split up. There's always like, sounds like some sort of 70s rock group going their own way for reasons of musical differences. But as you probably remember, Gondwanaland was that vast continental landmass that consisted what then became South America, Africa, India and Southeast Asia, Australasia, Australia. Australia and not, and this will turn out to be significant later, not New Zealand, which turns out to be just a lot of gunk that came up from under the ocean. And as I say, lemurs were dominant, the dominant primate around the world. And when all these land masses split up, and Madagascar was one of them, Madagascar kind of sailed off into the middle of what then suddenly became the Indian Ocean, and took with it a representative sample of the livestock of the period, which included a lot of lemurs. And they basically sort of sat there for millions and millions of years in glorious isolation, while in the rest of the world, a new creature emerged, a new creature arrived that was much more intelligent than the lemurs, according to it, much more competitive, much more aggressive, and incredibly interested in all the things you could do with twigs. Twigs were absolutely wonderful. There's so much you can do with twigs. You can dig in the ground for things with twigs. You can burrow under the bark of trees for grubs. You can hit each other with twigs. If there had been copies of Twig User magazine around in those days, these creatures would have been lining up for it. And these creatures, which were, as you probably guessed, called the monkeys, because they were more competitive and more aggressive, and they lived in the same habitat as the lemurs, they successfully supplanted the lemurs everywhere in the world other than Madagascar, because Madagascar was right out in the middle of the Indian Ocean and they couldn't get there. They couldn't get there until about 1500 years ago, when due to startling advances in twig technology, they were able to get there in boats and eventually planes, and suddenly the lemurs that had had this place to themselves for millions and millions and millions of years were suddenly facing their old enemy, the monkey. So this is Madagascar. And it turns out that the rarest of the lemurs, and when I say the rarest of the lemurs, at this particular point in the mid-80s, they were thought to be the rarest of the lemurs. We've now discovered an even rarer lemur called the golden bamboo lemur, which went straight to the number one of endangered lemurs. But the aye-aye is a very, very peculiar animal. It looks like an agglomeration of all sorts of other different animals. So, for instance, it has a sort of fox's ears, and it has little sort of bitey rabbit's teeth, and it has a kind of ostrich tail, ostrich feather as a tail, and it has very weird eyes. It has Marty Feldman's eyes. They're kind of sort of looking slightly beyond you into a sort of other dimension just over your left shoulder. But it also has one very, very, very peculiar characteristic, which is its middle finger on both hand is skeletally thin and very, very long. And it turns out there's only one other animal in the entire world that has this feature. And this is called, I love zoologists, they have such vivid imaginations. It's called the long-fingered possum. And this is a creature that lives in New Guinea. And in fact, it has its fourth finger that's skeletally thin and elongated. And this is the thing that tells us that there's no relationship between these animals. It's pure convergent evolution, because the common factor between Madagascar and the aye-aye and New Guinea and the long-fingered possum is that in both habitats there are no woodpeckers. And you see, the thing is, life is very, very opportunistic, and it'll take advantage of any food source it finds around the place. And if there are no woodpeckers looking for the bark, looking under the bark of trees for grubs, then in this case, it'll be the mammals that grow this skeletally thin long finger to burrow under the bark of the tree and get at this source of food, which is the grubs under the bark. So the eye-eye is this very, very, very strange creature. And at this time, it was thought there were only about 15 of them left. And they lived actually not on Madagascar itself, but on a tiny little rainforest island just off the coast of Madagascar called Nosy Mangabe. And it was just off the northwest tip of Madagascar. Now, to get there, what you had to do is you had to fly in a 747 to Madagascar, and then in a terrible old jalopy of an aeroplane from Madagascar up to the northwest port. And from there, you had to go in a kind of decreasingly excellent series of carts and trucks and so on to a little port where there was going to be a boat that was going to take us to Nosy Mangabe. So we arrived there and arrived at the port, and we were looking around for the boat that was going to take us to Nosy Mangabe, and we couldn't see it. And we kept on asking people, you know, where's this boat? And they would say, it's there. And we couldn't see what they were pointing at because there was this terrible rotting old hulk in the way. Well, as you guessed, this is the terrible rotting old hulk that we had to go to Nosy Mangabe in. And it didn't fulfill what, to my mind, was the sort of basic criteria of a boat, in that it was basically full of ocean. And it seemed to me that the whole point of a boat was to keep the ocean on the outside. Anyway, so we crossed to Nosy Mangabe. And it's this tiny little, very, very beautiful little rainforest island. And we hit a major problem, which of course is that this animal not only lives in trees, nobody has seen it for years and years and years. Not only it lives in trees, but it's also a nocturnal animal. And the quality of batteries in Madagascar is very, very poor. So we spent night after night after night traipsing through the rainforest in what can only be described as the rain. Getting rather ratty. And basically, we just spent night after night sort of huddled under tarpaulins and looking, has it stopped raining yet? And every now and then, we'd sort of go out and try and find this damn animal. And we actually, there's this wonderful, we found this hut. It used to be the sort of game warden's, not game warden, it was a ranger's hut. And it was a tiny little hut. And it was actually full of wildlife. what happened, you see, is you'd open the door and you would hear all this noise. And you'd turn on the light and it would all stop. And you'd see these sort of giant spiders around the wall, each with a sort of half-eaten bug in their mouth. Say, yes? And you turn the light out and so this is our shelter. You know, we were having a great time. But one night, we were all sort of, as I say, huddled under our tarpaulins, and I sort of got out and had a wander around, and suddenly I looked up, and on a branch about that high above my head, this creature came out along the branch, looked down at me, and I looked at it, and as it looked at me, it obviously didn't at all like the look of what it saw. It turned around and went away again. Whole encounter about 10 seconds. And that's what we'd come for. that I had actually seen, and we saw, and we all just managed to get a quick photograph of it when it appeared, but I'd suddenly realized we'd seen an eye. Now, I was absolutely transfixed by that moment for reasons that I couldn't entirely explain to myself immediately. Because a month earlier, I'd never even heard of this animal, and now here I was staring at it, thinking there's something extraordinary happening here. So I began to sort of think about it a little bit. And the thought I put together was this, that in traveling here, in traveling on the 747 to Tananarive, which is the capital of Madagascar, in this terrible old jalopy of an airplane that took us up to the northwest corner, and then in the decreasingly excellent series of carts and trucks, and then in the rotting old hulk that took us to the rainforest, where we basically walked through the rainforest night after night. It was as if we were taking a kind of time journey, a time travel journey, back through the history of twig technology. And what this encounter had been, was I was a monkey looking at a lemur. And you suddenly think, there is a huge amount of history to this moment that we don't think, we don't realize we carry around with us. Our roots in this planet go back an awfully, awfully, awfully long way. And we don't tend to think about that very much. And it takes a confrontation like this suddenly to realize how sort of broad and deep your family goes. So I thought, well, this is terribly interesting. And I talked to the guy who'd been kind of my guide out there, who was a zoologist who'd been sent along to make sure I didn't sort of fall out of trees and so on. And his name was Mark Carwardine. And I said, I would love it if we could... do you fancy the idea of sort of going around the world and looking for other rare and endangered species of animal, maybe doing a book about it? And he said, well, that's what I do for a living. So yeah, okay. And so we did. Now, there was a pause at that moment because I had a couple of novels I'd just contracted to write. So I wrote Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency and The Long Dark Tea Time of the Soul, and then it was time to go. And the first place we went to look for a particular animal, which was the Komodo dragon lizard. Now, you know what lizards are like, don't you? I mean, they're sort of nice little sort of green. This, the Komodo dragon lizard is a little bit bigger than that. The biggest one we saw actually was about 13 feet long, and its head came up to about here. Huge, I think, is the technical term. It's thought they're the origin of the Chinese dragon myth because they are huge, giant lizards. They're scaly, they're man-eaters. Literally, they are man-eaters, and they don't actually breathe fire, but they do have the worst breath of any creature known to man. And they live on this island called Komodo. Now, it's not enough, it turns out, that this island has 1,500 man-eating dragons on it. It turns out that actually the most endangered animal on the island is anything other than the dragons. And in fact, they, when I say they're man-eaters, they don't actually eat you sort of straight out. They don't sort of lunge at you and just gobble you up. They sort of sneak around and they come and give you a bit of a bite, because the saliva is so virulent that your wound will not heal, and after a while you will die. And it doesn't. And so one of the dragons will get to eat you. It doesn't matter if it's the same one that ate you. They just have a strategy of having as many dead and dying creatures lying around the island as they can manage, and that kind of keeps them going. But it turns out it's not enough that the island has 1,500 man-eating dragons on it. Just to make it a little bit more interesting, it also has more poisonous snakes on it per square meter of land than any equivalent area of land anywhere on Earth. So We approached Komodo, I have to say, slightly nervously and in a slightly roundabout way. In fact, we approached it in such a roundabout way that we went via Melbourne in Australia. The reason we went via Melbourne was that somebody we wanted to go and see there, a man called Dr. Struan Sutherland. I actually wanted to read you a little bit of, about him. He was a great expert in snake venom. And I should apologize before I read this, actually, for the fact that I don't do a... My Australian accent isn't very good, but then, what the hell, you're all Americans, you won't know the difference anyway. There is in Melbourne a man who probably knows more about poisonous snakes than anyone else on earth. His name is Dr. Struan Sutherland, and he has devoted his entire life to a study of venom. And I'm bored of talking about it, he said when we went along to see him the next morning, laden with tape recorders and notebooks. Can't stand all these poisonous creatures, all these snakes and insects and fish and things, wretched things biting everybody, and then people expect me to tell them what to do about it. I'll tell them what to do. Don't get bitten in the first place. That's the answer. I've had enough of telling people all the time. Hydroponics, now that's interesting. Talk to you all you like about hydroponics. Fascinating stuff, growing plants artificially in water. Very interesting technique. We'll need to know all about it if we're going to go to Mars and places. Where did you say you were going? Komodo. Well, don't get bitten, that's all I can say. And don't come running to me if you do, because you won't get here in time. And anyway, I've got enough on my plate. Look at this office, full of poisonous animals all over the place. See, this tank's full of fire ants, venomous little creatures. What are we going to do about them? Anyway, I got some little fairy cakes in case you were hungry. Would you like some little cakes? I can't remember where I put them, ma'am. There's some tea, but it's not very good. Anyway, sit down, for heaven's sake. So, you're going to Komodo. Well, I don't know why you want to do that, but I suppose you have your reasons. There are 15 different types of snake on Komodo, and half of them are poisonous. The only potentially deadly ones are the Russell's viper, the bamboo viper, and the Indian cobra. The Indian cobra is the 15th deadliest snake in the world, and all the other 14 are here in Australia. That's why it's hard for me to find time to get on my hydroponics, all these snakes all over the place. And spiders. The most poisonous spider is the Sydney funnel web. We get about 500 people a year bitten by spiders. A lot of them used to die, so we had to develop an antidote to stop people bothering me with it all the time. Took us years. Then we developed this snake bite detector kit. Not that you need a kit to tell you when you've been bitten by a snake, you usually know, but the kit is something that'll detect what type you've been bitten by so you can treat it properly. Would you like to see a kit? I've got a couple here in the venom fridge. Here, let's have a look. Oh, look, the cakes are in here too, quick. Have one while they're still fresh. Fairy cakes, a bite to myself. He handed around these snake venom detection kits and his home-baked fairy cakes and retreated back to his desk, where he beamed at us cheerfully from behind his curly beard and bow tie. We admired the kits, which were small, efficient boxes neatly packed with tiny bottles, a pipette, a syringe, and a complicated set of instructions that I wouldn't want to have to read for the first time in a panic. And then we asked him how many of the snakes he'd been bitten by himself. Ah, none of them, he said. Another area of expertise that I've developed is that of getting other people to handle the dangerous animals. Won't do it myself, don't want to get bitten, do I? You know what it says on my book jackets? Hobbies, gardening with gloves, fishing with boots, traveling with care. That's the answer. What else? Well, in addition to the boots, wear thick, baggy trousers and preferably have half a dozen people tramping along in front of you making as much noise as possible. The snakes pick up the vibrations and get out of your way, unless it's a death adder, otherwise known as the death adder, which just lies there. People can walk right past it and over it and nothing happens. I've heard of 12 people in a line walking over a death adder and the 12th person accidentally trod on it and got bitten. Normally you're quite safe if you're 12th in line. You're not eating your cakes. Come on, get them down here. There's plenty more in the venom fridge. We asked tentatively if we could perhaps take a snake bite detector kit with us to Komodo. Ah, of course you can, of course you can. Take as many as you like. Won't do you a blind bit of good because they're only for Australian snakes. So what do we do if we get bitten by something deadly then? I asked. He blinked at me as if I was stupid. Well, what do you think you do? He said. You die, of course. That's what deadly means. But what about cutting open the wound and sucking out the blood, or sucking out the poison? I asked. Well, rather you than me, he said. I wouldn't want a mouthful of poison. Shouldn't do you any harm, though. I mean, snake toxins have a high molecular weight, so they won't penetrate the blood vessels in the mouth the way that alcohol or some drugs do. And then the poison gets destroyed by the acids in your stomach. But it's not necessarily going to do much good either. I mean, you're not likely to be able to get much of the poison out, but you're probably going to make the wound a lot worse trying. And in a place like Komodo, it means you'd quickly have a seriously infected wound to contend with, as well as a leg full of poison. Septicemia, gangrene, you name it, it'll kill you. Well, what about a tourniquet? I asked. Well, fine, if you don't mind having your leg cut off afterwards. You'd have to, because if you cut off the blood supply to it completely, it'll just die. And if you can find anyone in that part of Indonesia you'd trust to take your leg off, then you're a braver man than me. Now, I'll tell you, the only thing you can do is apply a pressure bandage direct to the wound and wrap the whole leg up tightly, but not too tightly. Slow the blood flow, but don't cut it off, or you'll lose the leg. Hold your leg, or whatever bit you've been bitten in, lower than your heart and your head. Keep very, very still. Breathe slowly, and get to a doctor immediately. If you're on Komodo, that means a couple of days, by which time you'll be well dead. Now, the only answer, and I mean this quite seriously, is don't get bitten. There's no reason why you should. Any of the snakes there will get out of your way well before you even see them. You don't really need to worry about the snakes if you're careful. Now, the things you really need to worry about are the marine creatures. What? Scorpion fish, stonefish, sea snakes, much more poisonous than anything on land. Get stung by a stonefish, the pain alone will kill you. People drown themselves just to stop the pain. Where are all these things? Oh, just in the sea, tons of them. I wouldn't go near it if I were you. Full of poisonous animals, hate them. Is there anything you do like? Yeah, he said, hydroponics. No, I said, I mean, are there any poisonous creatures you particularly fond of? He looked out of the window for a moment. Ah, there was, he said, but she left me.
That was the first part of a roughly hour and a half long talk that Douglas Adams gave at the University of California in Santa Barbara in 2002, just a couple of months before his sudden death. This has been Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. Stay tuned now for Jimmy Icardi's Rock and Roll Party.